today in our enterprises at all.
You may proceed.
Good morning. I may please the court. My name is Kevin Motley, and I represent John Felischko and J&R Enterprises, your appellants this morning. Your Honors, the issue presented by this appeal is whether Appellee Ware Creek Real Estate Corporation is entitled to a real estate brokerage commission in connection with the sale of property in New Kent County known as the Jackass Flats property. The answer to that question is no, because Ware Creek did not produce a sale or exchange of the property to a purchaser during the exclusive period of its listing agreement, during any extension of that initial period, or during a 90-day non-exclusive period that followed the initial period.
May I ask you a preliminary question? The broker sought the brokerage fee under the contract, but also sought attorney's fees as a contractual claim. Am I right?
That's correct.
So the cause of action was breach of contract, and attorney's fees was not a motion for fees under a sanction or discovery rule or some collateral thing. It was a part of the cause of action for breach of contract. Is that half of the case still pending right now in the lower court?
No. As an initial matter, though, the argument you just raised has never been raised before in this case by either
party. Regrettably, if you want to look at it that way, we have to raise such questions because it goes to our jurisdictional power as opposed to our prudential authority.
I understand. Moving past that, though, that part of the case is dead.
Is what?
Is dead. And it doesn't have life in it anymore because the trial court's order, the March 29, 2017 order, gave judgment for the plaintiff on the breach of contract cause of action and then had a sentence in it that said something to the effect of the appellee, in this case Ware Creek, may produce evidence of attorney's fees at a later time.
Well,
under the Loomis Jen
case, was bifurcated. They didn't want to send the... They didn't want to put the lawyers on the witness stand in front of the jury, so it was quite sensibly bifurcated between the commission, let the jury decide that, and if the jury finds liability, the judge would take up the extra part of the case.
I do not believe there was ever a motion to bifurcate or an order bifurcating, but
it was bifurcated. Factually, it was bifurcated.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, whether you all agreed to it or not is beside the point. That's what the court did.
Our position is, as stated in the briefing on the motion to dismiss on that issue, and that is that March 29, 2017 order was the final judgment that did grant relief for the plaintiff and then did not adequately retain jurisdiction for the attorney's fees issue, which
What should the trial judge have done to retain jurisdiction other than saying I'm retaining this on the docket so I can decide the second half of the case?
Well, there's really no breach or cause of action related to the attorney's fees issue, though.
It's in the contract, isn't it?
Until there's been some determination as to whether there's been a breach of the contract. I'm sorry.
Well, it's in the contract. You brought a contract action. It included the question of attorney's fees. Everything has been resolved except that, and now you're up here. I mean, the import of Justice Kelsey's question is whether or not the order you've appealed is, in fact, a final order that is properly before the court. It's a pretty significant question.
Yes, and I understand and appreciate that. And our position is, yes, it is, under the Loomis Jen case that we've relied on that issue, which dealt with an attorney's fees issue, as I recall.
But it wasn't part of the cause of action. The plaintiff wasn't seeking attorney's fees in the cause of action. It was simply a collateral motion for fees based upon a non-suit that was arguably a second non-suit. So it's not like the normal situation where the court decides the case, the claim, the grounds of defense, everything. The jury decides it. But someone's got a JNOV or some motion to set aside or some motion for fees or some motion for something, and the trial judge just doesn't do anything about it. Well, then that goes away. The final order is the final order, but you're half of his case in theory, is still there. It hadn't been decided.
And again, we respectfully disagree with that position. We believe that that attorney's fees request is just like the, or analogous to, covered by the same analysis as the Loomis Gen case.
Why don't you get on with the merits of the case?
May I ask?
Sure, absolutely.
Does the October 3rd, 2017 order impact your analysis at all?
That would be...
Dismissing the motion to dismiss.
Oh, in this court?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, this issue has been presented to the court and was argued, and there was a motion pending that was dismissed, I believe, by the order that you're referencing.
Right.
So we would rely on that as well.
All right. It's an important issue, but you also have other matters that you need to address.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. To the merits of the case, during the 90-day period that followed the initial period of time, Ware Creek did obtain the signatures of two individuals who were named George Allen and Monty Brown on a real estate purchase contract dated June 2nd, 2008, which I'll refer to as the 2008 contract. But it's undisputed that Brown and Allen lacked the money to buy the property. It's undisputed that that contract had a contingency in it. That was a financing contingency. They also referred in different places to the purchaser being an LLC named Jackass Flats LLC. It's undisputed that Jackass Flats LLC did not exist at that time and did not exist at any time during the 90-day period. It was formed at some point later. So we have a contract here during this 90-day period that does have people's names and signatures on it, but it has contingencies that couldn't be met and never were met, and if the purchaser is viewed as an LLC, it doesn't exist. So given those two facts, that simply wasn't a contract or a sale within the meaning of the listing agreement. And we did not, John Felishko, J&R Enterprises, did not hire Ware Creek to obtain an invalid contract with a non-existent LLC or with purchasers who may have been willing to buy the property, but who were not able to buy the property. They were not ready, willing, and able purchasers at any time during the relevant time period. Now, turning to the law, fundamental foundational block of Virginia's law as it relates to broker's commissions is found in Ford v. Gibson, where it says that a broker's right to commissions must, of course, be based on a valid contract, express or implied. Turning to the listing agreement, it says that to get a commission, the broker must accomplish a sale. The property must be sold or exchanged. There must be a sale. So Ware Creek was hired to sell. Now, that is not defined in the listing agreement. That concept is not defined in the listing agreement. So what does it mean? Turning to Virginia law, this court has written repeatedly that a broker employed to sell, as distinguished from a broker employed to find a purchaser ready, willing, and able to buy, is not entitled to compensation until he effects a sale or procures from his customer a valid and enforceable contract of sale. And again, that simply did not happen here at any time during the 90-day period. And all of this leads to the conclusion that the 2008 contract was not a sale. A sale didn't happen until 2009, 1 year later, when different investors in this LLC emerged, or a different investor. The LLC was properly formed. There was a completely separate contract formed, again, a year later after a period of 7 months of no activity. And it was that contract that went to closing. So, Your Honors, under the law of Virginia, under the listing agreement, no sale occurred within the term of the listing agreement that would trigger the right to a commission. I'd like to reserve the balance 6 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may it please the Court. My name is Thomas Stark. I represent the appellee in this case, which is Ware Creek Real Estate Corporation.
Did the 2009 contract have a condition clause in it?
It did not, Judge. It was not. I'm sorry. Chief Justice Lindeman.
Well, let me follow up with that. If it didn't, what is there about it that incorporates that provision from the 2008 contract? If this is not a modification of the 2008 contract, but it's a new contract altogether, upon what do you base your claim for a commission?
So, Your Honor, our position is it's not a new contract. Let's take a look at the aspects of the two contracts. In 2008, we had a purchaser which was listed in the 2008 contract as Jack Asphalt LLC. In 2009, the purchaser was Jack Asphalt LLC. The seller, the same, J&R Enterprises and John Felichko.
But the financing is different. I mean, that's kind of a big deal, isn't it?
To an extent, Your Honor. In the 2008 contract, none of the blocks are checked on that contract which would have limited the contingency as to financing. Certainly there was a contingency as to financing. The language used was suitable and adequate. Adequate and suitable. And it was put in two places on that contract. It was put in the seller financing block, and it was put in the other block for any other kind of financing. Well,
doesn't that mean the seller would have the option of saying, look, I'm not doing 90% owner financing?
The seller had the option to reach an agreement with the purchaser for suitable and adequate. And so that contingency meant if it was going to be seller financing, they had to agree on the terms. It wasn't as if the purchaser could ram down the throat of the seller some term that the seller didn't want. They had to agree on the terms. In the 2009 contract, they did agree on the terms. And so that contingency that is in the 2008 contract was fulfilled.
Well, vis-a-vis the buyer and the seller, but vis-a-vis the seller's agreement to pay a broker fee, it's a completely different deal.
Judge, it's the same purchase price. It's the same purchaser. It's the same seller. It's the same piece of property.
The money's all different. I mean, if we're buying and selling something and I say to you, well, I may agree on financing at some point, but I don't know what I'm going to do. And the next deal is, no, 90% is coming out of you, Mr. Kelsey. I would say, whoa.
So, Your Honor, in the first contract, it did not eliminate the potential that they come to that exact same deal.
That same deal
would have satisfied, and in fact, by the very language, did satisfy the 2008 contract.
Well, what about the fact that they did not come to that agreement under that contract?
Your Honor, if you say that they didn't come to that agreement under that contract, what you then say is any buyer and any seller can cut out the real estate agent by simply writing another contract.
But wouldn't they have to come to that agreement within 90 days under the agreement between the exclusive sell agreement?
Your Honor, that is the position of the appellant in this
Isn't
case.
Isn't that the wording of the contract?
Well, Your Honor, the wording of the contract is that the property, if within 90 days after the expiration of the initial period or an extension thereof, the property is sold or exchanged. And so in order for the court to believe that it has to be within that 90 days, that's to say any contract with any contingency that is entered into in that 90-day period cannot satisfy the broker's commissioning language unless the contingency is removed within that 90-day period. And as the amicus brief and as we have set forth, Your Honor, that imposes upon the broker an extra layer of obligation that we don't believe that's what the contract requires. What the contract requires is that the owner agree to the contingencies, not necessarily to be performed within that period of time unless the contract is a time is of the essence or unless the financing contingency has a definite termination date. The trial court very aptly decided in this case, as a matter of fact, This contract had no termination date on the financing contingency, and this contract in 2008 was not a time is of the essence contract.
But the extension thereof language in the brokerage agreement, the listing agreement, is extension of the brokerage agreement 90-day period, not extensions of the buy-sale agreement.
Well, Your Honor, it says if within 90 days after expiration of the initial period, and the initial period expired on May the 1st, Your Honor. There's no doubt about that. And during that initial period, there was an exclusive right of the broker to sell the property.
Right.
We're not claiming that there was a contract.
So during the 90-day period, there was no acceptance, there was no sale. You can extend the 90-day period, right?
You could have extended the initial listing, Your Honor.
Right, so you can extend the initial period of time, which was the May 1 deadline, or you can extend the 90-day extension of the May 1 deadline. But neither one of those were extended.
Neither one of those were extended, Your Honor. But if that is important, Judge, what you're saying is that the sale has to be, the property has to be conveyed within that 90-day period of time.
Well, I think the questions you're hearing is it's not we're saying anything. We're just trying to read it and understand it, and it seems to say that, doesn't it?
It doesn't, Your Honor. Because the rest
of
the contract...
Did you say it doesn't?
It doesn't. Because the rest of the contract makes a distinction between sold and conveyed.
And the trial court construed those terms, and that's not before us. Right.
That's correct, Judge. That was a finding of fact. The trial court construed those terms to say sale
did
and conveyance.
Did the trial
different.
Court construe them, or did the trial court rely on a decision that was made in a non-suited case?
Well, Judge, the trial court did review the reasoning of the decision made by, I think,
well,
it was Judge
Martin.
Well,
the trial court said Judge so-and-so decided that this was sold, and Judge so-and-so did it in a case that was non-suited.
And he also cited the judge who had made that determination in the present case, the refiled case, Your Honor.
Where did he do that,
which was Judge
Rubb.
I'm sorry?
Where did he do that?
I believe it's in his letter of opinion, Your Honor.
But the language of the contract, no one's arguing it's ambiguous. It's a question of law for the court.
There are factual findings and there are interpretations of contract. And I agree with Your Honor that the interpretation of the contract is a matter of de novo. The factual issues are a matter to be given great deference to the trial court unless plainly wrong without evidence to support them.
So is interpreting the 90-day period and the language initial period of time or any extension thereof, is that a question of fact for the fact finder or a question of law for every judge up the chain of command?
Judge, I believe that this court has the power to review the term sold, which I think is the key term in that clause that you make reference to, on a de novo basis.
Okay, so it wasn't sold within the deadline of May 1, and it wasn't sold within the 90-day period, and the 90-day period wasn't extended.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, because my disagreement comes with the point that sold does not mean conveyed. It doesn't require that a deed be passed within 90 days. The contract requires that there be a contract. If you look at the listing agreement, Your Honor, the person is given the exclusive right to sale and that he must exercise all reasonable efforts to procure a buyer. So he procured a buyer, Your Honor. He procured a buyer with a contract that had two contingencies. The first contingency that the LLC be formed, and as a matter of fact, Your Honor, that contingency may not have been an absolute necessity to the enforcement of that contract because the purchasers signed the contract in their individual capacity. And so the buyer may well have been able to enforce it against the purchasers had they never made reasonable effort to form the LLC.
Before you run out of time, can you address 13.1-1007, which says that it's a misdemeanor to even conduct business with a LLC that's not registered as a LLC?
Your Honor, I understand the court's point, and I would cite the court to the Geographic Network affiliate case, which was interpreting the same statutes which go to whether an LLC can be can conduct business in this Commonwealth before it is formed. And in that case, Your Honor, the Geographic Network case, and Your Honor, quite grandly, it was a trial court. It was not the Supreme Court, and so it is persuasive authority that the corporation can assume the rights and obligations of the contract entered into by promotion prior to the legal existence of the corporation. So what we have in this case, Your Honor, is not the LLC trying to get out of a contract, not the seller trying to void the purchase contract, because that was accomplished. The property was sold by the seller to the buyer that was in the 2008 contract. What we have, Your Honor, is the buyer, the owner, the seller, trying to get out of its obligation to the real estate agent. And so that harm, Your Honor, is not what the statute is designed to affect. And that was made clear in the Blick case, which was actually cited by the other court, by the other party, Your Honor. The court must examine the language of the statute, the subject matter, the wrong it seeks to address, and the purpose to be accomplished in its enactment. And if from these it is manifest that it was not intended to render the act in contravention of the statute void, the courts will so hold.
But there was no 13.1-1007 in that case. And we have a statute.
In the Blick case, Your Honor?
Right. So we have a statute that says it's a crime. It's not just unenforceable, it's a crime. You can, in theory, be prosecuted and put in jail for 12 months for it. That's not pretty strong
language. I can't argue with that point, Your Honor. I understand that point. However, the purpose of that statute is to prevent LLCs from misidentifying themselves or being in some way fraudulent in their use of LLC as a business entity.
Right.
In this case, that LLC had the desire to become, the people who were forming it, the people who signed that 2008 contract, wanted to become an LLC, and they did in August of 2008 while they were still working on that contract.
Which is probably why no one would ever prosecute them for that reason. But that doesn't make it lawful.
Lawful is a difference between there's a difference between whether it's lawful and whether this court decides the actions are void. An action may be contrary to the law, as in the Blick case. It was contrary to the law that this attorney represented that person when that attorney had been a substitute judge. However, that doesn't mean that that attorney wasn't capable of recovering their fees for that representation. It was not lawful, Your Honor. However, the actions didn't prejudice the person they represented. In fact, they helped. And so the court decided it was not going to make that void.
Let me ask you this. Suppose there, and I'm sorry, his name escapes me, but a new investor was brought into the deal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Back end. Suppose he doesn't fulfill his obligations. Is there any remedy against him? So he's supposed to bring X amount of funding to the deal, and he doesn't. Is there any contractual remedy? And what my question gets at, just to be candid with you, is there's this debate about what contract are we looking at? You're saying, oh, it's all the same. But they're not exactly the same because the financing was different and there's this new investor. So I'm trying to figure out, are you right that, oh, this was the same contract, it's just they fulfilled this contingency? Or is it a new and different contract? Because if it's a new and different contract, I don't see how your client gets a commission.
Your Honor, if this were a completely different deal, if there were different parties that were investing, if the terms of the deal, and Your Honor, granted, I have 27 seconds left. I'm probably not going to answer your question, so I'm asking the court for permission to answer the question beyond
the time.
You're
right ahead. Thank you. Answer the question.
But Your Honor, if there had been a different party involved, and this party is an LLC, and granted, Your Honor, they did have an additional investor, it's still an LLC in both contracts. If the purchase price had been different, if there had been other remarkable terms that were not contemplated by the first contract. And the first contract contemplates the potential for seller financing. There was testimony at trial about discussing seller financing before this 2009 contract. It wasn't until 2009 that they ultimately came to an agreement as to that contingency. But, Your Honor, it is basic. It is the same deal, absent the one says this is a way that the contingency can be satisfied, and the other says this is how we satisfy the contingency.
Thank you.
All right, your time has expired. Rebuttal?
I'd like to go back to where we started with a question on the finality of the order very briefly. The way we analyze that issue starts with the case law, this court's case law. In particular, the Superfresh case, where the court said that when a trial court enters an order or a decree, which this is, in which a judgment is rendered for a party, in which happened in this order, the order says this matter has come before the court, and goes on to say that the court is entering judgment, grants judgment against the defendants jointly and severally, etc. So you can check both of those boxes from the Superfresh language.
So if there was a partial judgment?
Didn't say that.
Well, it was in fact because half the case had not been adjudicated.
But in any case that comes before a trial court in which the litigant fails to ask for relief in the judgment for all the things they've asked for, that's on them. There are ways this court has expressed to litigants how to save that. You can put it in the final order that you're retaining jurisdiction.
But the plaintiffs here asked for two things in their breach of contract, and the trial judge said, I'll decide the second one after the first one's decided.
There's no order that says that, Your Honor, and that's what this court has said must happen. The court, they could have asked for 100 things, and if they only got a judgment on two things and failed to retain jurisdiction on the 98th, they'd be out of luck. But there's a path for them to save that from happening, and they failed to avail themselves of that. They didn't put language in the final order, which they drafted, retaining jurisdiction. They didn't do it. And under Superfresh and under Loomis Gin, a judgment was entered. That's important language. It has consequences.
Well, right, judgment was, I guess the point is, the judgment was entered, but not as to all issues.
That's correct.
But if that's correct, we have a rule that has a nomenclature, partial judgment. And in order to get up here, you have to have a trial judge certifying that it is a partial judgment. There's a very specific language in the rule and a very specific process. And that is what I think Justice Kelsey is saying, but he can say it better than I.
I'm familiar with the new partial judgment rule. I'm not sure when that came into effect, date-wise, but...
Well, it came into effect before your appeal, I can tell you that.
The order here was March 29, 2007. Our position, I think I've stated it, is that if you go to judgment in an order and you fail to get all the relief sought, and there's nothing retaining jurisdiction, it's a final order.
All right, well, go ahead.
All right. Turning to some of the issues on the merits, even if these were, Justice McCullough, the same, even if these two contracts were the same contract, the June 2008 contract and then the contract in June of 2009, there's still no commission owed here because the first contract in June 2008, number one, was invalid when it was signed and couldn't have even become valid with that LLC until well after the 90-day period, point number one. Number two, though, it was contingent on something happening. And this court has held that the contract under that situation is made in form but does not become operative as a contract until some future specified act is performed or some subsequent event occurs. That's from the Moritok case.
Right, but my point was if they're different contracts. I mean, I follow the analysis of the court looking at the overall contract and saying, well, if there's an agreement, it doesn't actually have to be effectuated within the 90 days, but there is a contract within the 90 days. What I was struggling with is it looks like a contract that in many ways, there are several significant ways, is different. So you have a new That's and correct. Different contract. And if it is a new and different contract, I don't think there's any argument that a commission is owed.
Agreed. And that would be my next point, is that you shouldn't find that this is the same contract because there are significant differences. I should point out that...
I don't think there was any dispute that originally the deal fell apart on the question of financing, and it came back together months later, and there's no argument of bad faith or any of that, when, someone got tired of the property sitting around and said, well, all right, I'll stick my neck out a little bit and I'll do some different financing.
And even then, even when the seller was willing to do owner finance of 90% of the sales price, which was never discussed back in 2008. Even then, these two gentlemen, Brown and Allen, didn't have the money. They still didn't have the money. They were still willing. They were always willing, but they were not able or ready. They had to go get Mr. Brockhart, I believe his name was, or Brockwell, who brought more cash to the table. So there are big differences between those two contracts. It's apparent from the briefing and from the argument today that Appley's argument is basically all you need is a signed contract to get the commission. All you need is a signed contract. And that's just not what the contract says. It's not what the law says. This comes right from Virginia case law, the Ford v. Gibson case. If a broker's employment is to sell, which this contract said his job was to sell, or Ware Creek's job is to sell, he is not entitled to a compensation until he procures a sale or a valid and enforceable contract of sale. And that 2008 contract was simply not valid and enforceable. My time is up, Your Honors. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your argument. The court will be in recess until 10 minutes after 11.
All rise. Thank you.